It's my great pleasure to introduce Birger Svensson. Birger is a professor at the Oslo School of Architecture and Design and chairman of Ocean Design Research Association. His research and publications focus on systems-oriented design, creativity, and research by design. He is trained as an interior architect and furniture designer and has practiced in architecture and interior design, furniture and industrial design, as well as art. He is a member of the Council of the Design Research Society and has developed research that focuses on advancing systems-oriented design thinking and practice in order to meet the increased challenges of globalization and the need for sustainability. He has a PhD in creative design computing and has been researching systems thinking and design for the last 10 years. Please join me in welcoming Birger Svensson.
No? Is this better? Okay. Thank you very much for being invited to this great event. We had two very interesting and inspiring lectures already, so I hope you won't be disappointed, but about the fact that I'm not really an expert in sustainability, nor am I a biologist. I am a designer and interested in how we can work with this immense complexity that unfolds before us when we talk about these things. We have talked in detail about birds, and it is clear that when we design for environments that sort of should fold up on each other, the environment for the birds and the environments for humans, it is very clear that the task is immensely complex, and there's a lot of knowledge needed, and the way we design has to be rethought. And then there's the other 8 million species. How do we design for that complexity? And my talk will be to address this problem, to address possible practices for such a non-anthropometric design approach, and to suggest some kind of concepts or ways or methods to do that. And I think that maybe it will be interesting for some of the students here also to think in that way. I will suggest what we call systems-oriented design as one way to do it. I think there are other concepts and ways of thinking also. This lecture has four parts. First, I will talk a little bit about systemic design thinking and how we have been thinking about that, and show you three cases. Then I will suggest to you a concept that came out in the preparation to this event, the idea of the thick boundary as a way of framing how to design into this field we are talking about. And then I couldn't help trying to collect some samples of to indicate what is the current state of designing for other species, and just as an inspiration to think about what else could it be how to design in that field. And then one case that indicates, a final case that indicates the process. Now, I realize that I don't really have the ideal cases to show you. So you have to imagine a little bit in between what I'm showing you and layer it on top of each other. And then maybe there's some contours of what we want to do next year. So let's start with the first section about talking a little bit about systems thinking. So At least in my country, sustainability is discussed largely in industrial design as an issue of selecting the right materials, and that's it. Challenging that has seemed to be really a problem or very difficult. And in architecture, it's mainly or very often reduced to a question of energy, like calculating the energy amount of the house. So a more holistic approach is needed, and that's what we're going to talk about. So what is systems thinking, or what is a systems approach? This should actually run and move and be very interesting, but it just imagine it's running and doing things. On one side, we have a very quantitative approaches resulting in simulations and in modeling. You would have to quantify everything to put it into such a kind of simulation like you see here, and then try to reach and simulate the possible future. On the other side, or the other end of systems thinking, you have, as an example, you have a lot of things. You have soft systems, methodology, and so on. But you have, I'll just pick one of those elements. You have there the concept of wicked problems, which many of you know. Fewer people know that it actually grows out of a systems thinking environment. Some people might know that it's actually a designer who coined that term, Horst Rittl. He came from the Ulm School and went to Berkeley and became part of that, what was by Harold Nelson called the Berkeley bubble in systems thinking, which included great people like C. West Churchman and Russell Acuff. And so this term is actually embedded in a systems perspective. Many people know the term, but not everybody knows actually what are the 10 criteria. So it's worth repeating maybe some of them. Number one, there is no definitive formulation of a wicked problem. Defining wicked problems is itself a wicked problem. Wicked problems have no stopping rule. Solutions to wicked problems, well, it has no stopping rule. This means you don't know when you are finalized with solving the problem. Maybe it's not even the problem you're talking of. The problem will go on and develop after you've finished with your intervention. Solutions to wicked problems are not true or false, but better or worse. There is no immediate and no ultimate test of a solution to a wicked problem. Every solution to a wicked problem is a one-shot operation because there is no opportunity to learn by trial and error. So by doing an intervention in a system, you change the system. And if you want to do it again, the system is changed. So it's not what you want to achieve from what you learned is maybe not relevant. So you have these two very diametrical views or this large stretch in systems thinking. The question now is, how do we use that for designing? Let's come back to that. First, a little bit very basic of how we think about systems thinking at all. The ultimate example of systems thinking is ecology. It's ecology is interdisciplinary. It is about the interrelation between species and between hydroscopic systems and so on. So it's something you can't put into the lab as such. You can maybe simulate parts of it, but it's something that is very hard to fraction up. You have to look at it in a holistic way. And man is, as mentioned before, also considered more and more as part of the ecology. At least the relation between nature and man is really debated at the moment, and how we act from within that ecological systems rather than looking at them from the outside. So this has led to repositioning some of that thinking from the economical and social dimensions of human activities being embedded inside the ecological dimension. So this model of thinking of man as an embedded and as part of a bigger system that is ultimately our globe, or even including our solar system, has been very useful for changing the mind. So this holistic approach also leads to the realization that Gro Harlem Brundtland was mentioned yesterday, and she said that everything is connected to everything. Ultimately, the Gaia theory, like looking at the whole globe as one living organism, but the question then is, how do we design for that model or with that image in our head, with that conception of the world, that everything is connected with everything? It's not, it's a nice, a good perspective, but it's not a operational starting point. So at the moment, we have been thinking a little bit back and forth, and I think a lot of this is very premature, so you have to, I hope you, there will be a dialogue in the succession of this this event here. But so far we have been choosing to look at the interface between nature and human to maintain a type of boundary between what is called nature and human, and it's already been discussed a little with different standing points, interesting. And look at this boundary between what is nature and what is human as a useful focus. So we are looking especially at this boundary. And I will come back to this, and this concept of this boundary that we suggest is central in our thinking right now. So what is systems-oriented design? Systems-oriented design is design. It's not systems thinking, it's design, but it's oriented towards systems. Systems-oriented design is systems thinking and systems practice totally glued together and combined with design thinking and design practice. So we think of it more as a skill than a theorizing. So that's maybe it becomes operational and you can maybe use it. So what is the thinking, the design thinking or the systems thinking? A slogan, look beyond the object, think of everything as being super complex. So the object to the this object is obviously more complex than this one. For one reason, that this object is inside that object, probably somewhere. This is like a floating society. It is enormously complex when it comes to technology, but it also has a political and a social dimension. So what is the political dimension of that object? Looking behind the object, this little silly object is an intersection point between at least two super complex systems. One of them starting with maybe a woman in Colombia picking one coffee bean. And from that moment, there is this immense process going on, involving transportation, involving refinery, transportation involving crude oil, going through trade systems and refinery systems, and in the end, this bean ends up in that coffee. The other obvious system here, maybe start with a tree in the forest in Norway, and you have the same situation, there's a chainsaw, which is filled with the crude oil. You cut it down, you have the process of transportation, you have the process of bringing it to the paper mill, you have all the huge research field of paper processing, you have additional chemicals, you have waxing, you have print technologies, and so on. We haven't talked about what was before the tree was cut down or before the bean was picked, and we haven't talked about what came after the recycling element. And we haven't talked about the cultural dimension, coffee being a socializing element in our culture at least. But the political dimension of this object becomes, grows out of it and becomes clear. It's about differences in the world. It's about globalization. It's about justness or right trade, justful trade, or what you call it. So this object then becomes a symptom of something much more complex. Why would we bother doing this? For me, it's about rethinking, opening up, and fetishism for the object, and creating, one thing is it becomes much more interesting. Of course, it's a fascinating little thing, but it also opens up for creativity. It opens up the box so you can act in many different ways. So this is basically how we are thinking about this. So in systems-oriented design, we look at businesses, organizations as ecologies. Sustainability is not only a matter of being green, but also a matter of technology, economy, management, culture, politics, and markets. So this is what we have to take on a responsibility for as designers. When we suggest something, we also have to have a caring intention for the economy of our clients. Of course, it doesn't exclude it. So what is our object at the moment, which we want to look behind? It's, in our case today, a non-anthropocentric approach to design. So let's look a little bit behind that. How can we understand and design for a non-anthropocentric approach by looking at the processes behind it and what processes in human society that needs to be triggered to make it happen? Coping with that kind of super complexity in the design process, we need to get a holistic overview. We need to see the landscape we are operating in. And this landscape is already partly unfolded for us this morning. And it's obviously immensely complex. We need to build the necessary knowledge. We don't need to become biologists, or we cannot become biologists. We need to build exactly the amount of knowledge we need for each case, and we need to network and co-create with experts. And then in our case, user-centered design, which is very popular with the industrial designers and where I'm coming from, and co-creation and so on, we have to remember that the central stakeholders won't be able to voice their opinion, though there was one example that they might just do that. I will present to you, I cannot go through a lot of this, but just very shortly cut through it. One technique that we have been tested in many cases, also with students, master students, but also with companies and partners, trying to draw that holistic overview, to draw that landscape you want to design within. And this is what's called gigamapping. It's very much inspired by what in soft systems methodology is called the rich picture. But the gigamap is an artifact where it goes beyond being descriptive. It's also generative. We design it as an artifact, and we design this landscape as much as we describe it. Maybe the easiest way to understand what this might be, this kind of freestyling mapping, is to look at three projects. And these projects are chosen because of they show some useful combinations of layers of things that you can translate into working with the relations between human constructs and nature. So the first project, it's an EV charging solution. Quick charging for electrical vehicles. And the interesting thing about this is how this cuts across scales. So the urban fabric, social conditions, economic issues, lifestyle, and culture all needs to be addressed in that project. So this is the giga map of of Wei Zhang, who did this project. She tries to grasp the whole. This is her landscape of what needs to be addressed in this project. I won't go into this because we don't have the time, but I will show a little bit of an extract as an example. She made this for a special part of Oslo, a higher mid-income area, where for that community especially. And the special thing there is that there is no private parking. So how do you provide a system for charging your electrical vehicle in that community? The urban makeup and the fact that there is that the pattern of the parking has to be addressed in a different way. What she did was to this doesn't work anymore. I don't know. There. I'm just too quick. Okay. So she had to do several things, operate on several levels, like arrange ways of organizing the waiting time for if one station is occupied, to know how it is occupied and to arrange the queue, to network, to make a social interaction, network around this waiting time. So there has to be an information exchange. And there's also, I mean, we have been mentioning this this cultural dimension and the importance of how information and knowledge and intentions of people, how important they are to reach the change. So this is addressed here. But also she implements an added value or an added functionality that helps saving money in the household in general. And in addition, she addresses the emotional part of it, leisure, curiosity, natural, and zen. You can discuss this project, of course, and you can think it's kind of far out with this thing you sit inside. But I think the interesting thing is how it cuts across from the urban scale right down to the personal individual emotion. And I think can be translated and used in what we are talking of when we design for a non-anthropocentric approach with the crows and the other 8 million species. Adrian Paulson, Cleaning Up Our Act, it's an example of a project where the combination of social awareness, networking, and technology are coupled. So this is the vessel Full City that went on ground in the Oslofjord, and we want to design for those situations as industrial designers. We want to maybe, we think it's interesting to work in that area, but the typical thing would be to work with this, to make better things that clean up the mess. Now, Adrian started from that starting point, but ended up with looking at the whole system. This is his sort of his Giga map, and it's sequential. It starts here, and it takes you through a whole scenario of oil spill. And it has a bifurcation some places like here, where you would prevent this from happening. So he was looking at the much earlier stage in that chain of events and thought that that's where I can do the design intervention that is more useful. So he combined stakeholders in a network, social network, so that and combined that with the risk analyzing algorithm, which he verified from a university mathematician at the University of Oslo, so that it was just to know that it was possible to do it. And he created this system of, where is this red dot here? Yeah, this gadget which is online, which is fed by risk analysis, just like a weather report. Well, if there's bad weather and there's a highly risky Russian ship going past our coast, the risk would go up because you would know the positions of all the ships. But it's also, there's an input. You can put in a local observation. And the stakeholders include both Coast Guard professionals, tow boats, so you could move a tow boat and be prepared to a certain point. That was the problem with Full City. The tow boats were not there, but even they knew that there was a very, very high risk. It includes also leisure boat or fishermen and non-official stakeholders. And it's this kind of addressing the emotions with this driftwood gadget. So again, cutting across scales and looking differently at time, you have to translate it to be adequate for our situation. The last of those three examples is Francesco Zorzi, which made this kind of really interesting suggestion for how to looking at super distributed energy harvesting. His speculation was, what would be if all our objects were energy plus objects, like all of them would create more energy that they spend, and they would put it into a piggy bank, like select small amounts of energy during everything what you do. If it's feasible, this is like a discursive project, but I think you have also to think at that level. This is connected to bigger structures, of course, in how it's situated. But in designing for a non-anthropocentric approach, I think you also need to look at this very, very little things and details. So if you put this on top of each other and then turn around, maybe, and shake it, maybe you can get an idea of how you can design for our 10 minutes. Thank you. That was a good one. So I have to speed up. We have been talking about cultural tolerance. This is a problem, like with looking back at this kind of micro approaches, and that the cultural dimension is quite important. The cultural tolerance for other species has been shrinking. It seems to getting to a level where it's harmful for us, for ourselves. Being too clean generates reactions for the body. So we need to involve across these scales and layers. So the boundary problem, so how do we draw this boundary? We need to construct a boundary that is useful for our design process. The boundary is a boundary problem, is a very known problem in systems thinking. We are looking, we claim to look at the boundary as an artifact which we can construct for our purposes. And this is such an artificial boundary. This is from industrial ecology. And the boundary here is this dotted or dashed line. This is the municipality boundary, border of the municipality of Varberg. And this is the nitrogen in and out combox analysis, they call it, for the Institute of Varberg. So this system boundary is, of course, artificial. It's an artifact. It's made by the institution. But it's operational because the entity of Varberg, of the municipality of Varberg, can actually act upon that model and they can change things. So while the boundary is just an artifact, it's very useful. So in systems theory, the environment is defined as the entities that influence the systems, but that the system can't influence. So everything that you can't influence directly is regarded as the environment of the system. So the system's boundary then is regarded as to be clear and a thin boundary. It's like a very clearly defined boundary. But is it that easy? It's not so easy to really think in that way. If you think of animals feeding on their environment, they also change the environment. And
do we then have to include the environment in the animal system? Or do we have to maintain a different and more nuanced concept of environment and a tighter relation or a more interrelated way? So this is the salamander food web. So somewhere there are the parasites. And what is the food web of the parasites? So you would have like unfolding, and then you would have more unfolding. So what is the, actually the draws the boundary of that food web? Okay. So there's a known set of theory and bound in systems thinking that is called boundary critique that actually addresses these problems. But I will jump this because I'm running a bit short. So what we're suggesting is to look at the boundary again, and we suggest this idea of the thick boundary. When we look at the complexity in which nature and the artificial is interrelated or should be interrelated, it seems that ever more stuff takes place within this boundary condition. The boundary appears to be more an infiltrated weave or gradient than a membrane. This is our first sketches we did on the blackboard with the chalk. It's really nice. This, of course, has stopped, and we need to have biologists and other people to join that. But basically, it's a gradient from nature to the artificial here. But there's much more inside that. So the thick boundary is a multi-layered fabric of interwoven relations, and that's our design space. That's what I'm suggesting is our design space. So that was the kind of the thoughts and ideas we had. So now I want to jump to just to see, quickly flip through a few examples of what is done in that design space today. And then a flip through a project that is incomplete. Yeah, 5 minutes, that should be quite okay. So I had the great joy in Google and finding these things. And I sorted it sort of at along two axes that are parallel, one going from domesticated animals, but free living, to wild animals. And the other one goes a bit across being a very small scale to large scale interventions, from let's say architectures to landscape interventions. I'm just flip through. This is the common eider house, which is quite normal in Norway. They are free living, but people harvest their does from the nest, and they provide the shelters for them. We will have more dove coves. That's from the El Palomar de Brena in South Spain, a very big one. These feeding racks are, of course, also, you could say, wildlife and sometimes also semi-domesticated. This one we know. And we have a good colleague who we were discussing. He was like laughing about us because we were concerned about these little silly things like bathhouses. And he said, well, he's a very good architect, very renowned, and he's a good guy. But he said, well, I can make a bathhouse before lunch if you want. So I was looking into bathhouses and I found them to be not that simple. They have these kind of things, and there's some kind of really nice constructions here. And some of them not integrated in these examples, but attached to houses. I like this one. This is the rocket box type of bathhouse. So go home and build them. And this magnificent, very characteristic bathhouse from Florida and from Iraq. And then we go towards infrastructures and like the frog tunnels and the wildlife bridges, and in the end, the big planning things like maintaining corridors for wildlife to maintain their minimum space for survival, for living. now at the end, last 2 or 3 minutes, a case that indicates a process and how we actually can design for that. And this is an incomplete case, but it shows an intensity and a accuracy. It's from Michael's studio. I was joining that and helping. In both investigating the environment and the material systems for something very little and humble, like a little house for ducks. So I will just flip through part of their 65 slides, which was their analysis and the research document for building this little house for ducks. This is the site there in the little pond in a very urban area. It's the same area, actually, as where this EV charging project was, coincidentally the same area. And this is their GigaMap, understanding the whole landscape of problems, of forces, stakeholders, things that would influence the project. So you see, Little Duck House is not is like exploded into something very, very complex. There were site analysis, like what kind of species of trees were growing there. There were what kind of patterns of movements and lighting. And there's sightline analysis, this one. Anthropocentric. there's an analysis of people by activity, and there's a small analysis of the ducks knowledge. Now, what is lacking here is would be a really deep analysis of the ducks. Ironically, this is missing. we can be open about criticizing this. So imagine to put on these layers. Maybe some of the layers here are should be dampened down and made smaller, but others should be developed much further. But it shows sort of a level of engagement and level of willingness to take on information. These are the weather analysis, wind measurements, and some of it is taken from the net. Some of it is from documents or from measurements on the site. And then going to the material systems. And they choose to use willow as a material, which of course is very gentle and makes sense. They investigated the whole systems, how to, and the material properties and the strengths and so on. And started to do environmental tests. Maybe, well, you can easily criticize it, but they did this, I especially like these snow tests, very nice, and reached this kind of final design suggestion. Again, now add to this the layers of things you would do when you if you would do this again. And from what we were, have been talking about and from the theme of today, how would you do it? Obviously, you would maybe look at it in a bigger context. You would look at how the mallards migrate between ponds and such things and what they feed from and so on. This was fitting very well with the birds. So this is it. Thank you. You can visit our website to get more information.
I think we have time for one question.
Yeah. We have a freestyling dogma. It's like we do all kinds of stuff. So there are many different types of maps, which I haven't shown. But we ended up with doing very hands-on, use paper and markers, and then Illustrator. But we are frequently, well, some people use software, mapping software. But we want to go there. But for now, I didn't really find mapping software that would be that wouldn't kind of mold the process, where the frame of the software would take over and kind of shape the whole process. But for parts of it, I would like to do that and investigate that. So it's on our agenda to try to go back and recycle the. Let's see how we can use simulations. I know you are very much into that. That would be a really cool thing to go there. But we don't want to lose the layering of the different information. And some of the simulation things you would say don't mix apples and oranges, but that's exactly what we have to do and need to do. What's that?
We
worked a lot with that, and we think out of the computer. We don't think a computer screen is sufficient. It doesn't have the resolution we need, so we use big plots and we use huge formats, and we basically fill the whole space, and we create more space even to have a lot of information. With something that you could do here, the students, if you have very complex problems, you should actually, like in a war room style or like in a crime series, put everything up on the wall, because if you have it in your computer only, you will forget about it somewhere down there, and you won't be able to see the whole of it. And the interesting and the potential thing in it is to relate these different things. So create your visual space for design. If you want to design for super complexity, that's very important.
Okay, thank you very much, Birger Svelson.